Ooh, you want to play psycho killer? Can I be the helpless victim?
Cross your eyes and scream, man. Scream for your life.
Welcome. I'm your scream queen, Jenica Olin. This is my fourth episode. I'm very much in the early stages of my transformation into a horror podcast creator. So I will tell you a little bit about what you're listening in on. My objective for this podcast is to delve into the themes of horror, both real and imagined. Each episode will cover one movie in depth based on a theme of the month. This month's theme is all about slaying at this Christmas, and the movie Black Christmas is a great way to slay all day in December. Monday, December 16th, will be my next horror event at Conduit in Orlando, Florida. I will play the original Black Christmas movie and pause briefly to host rounds of trivia. The movies I base my events on are also what I cover each month on this podcast. Today, I will be going over the 1974 classic Black Christmas, directed by Bob Clark. I'm basically doing a three-part series on the Black Christmas movies. I will also cover the 2006 remake directed by Glenn Morgan and the 2019 remake directed by Sophia Tikal. While these films follow the same premise, each film has made it their own. If you want to know more, you'll have to listen to the next two episodes. A quick layout of this podcast. Each episode will have an intro, a brief synopsis of the movie, and then I have a guest or I discuss the movie on my own, and we wrap it all up with the true crime of it all. I'm a huge true crime fan, and I like to make connections between the true horrors that inspire our darkest imaginations. The truth is, the stuff on screen is way tamer than the true horrors that take place every day. In today's episode, we are killing it this holiday season with the original Black Christmas. Let's set the scene with the synopsis of the movie.
Remember those idyllic scenes out of your childhood? Crisp winter nights, star bright, sleigh bells, crackling Yule logs, candlelight glistening off of shimmering Christmas trees, chestnuts roasting over open fires, carolers beneath snow-covered window ledges. Remember those. Remember them well. After Black Christmas, they'll never be the same again. Black Christmas, starring Olivia Hussey, Keir Dulley, Margot Kidder, and starring John Saxon as Lieutenant Fuller. If this movie doesn't make your skin crawl, it's on too tight.
Late one night, in a snow-covered college campus, there is a Christmas party underway in one of the sorority houses. Outside in the snow, someone is looking into the windows. The person breathes heavily as they prowl around the property, eventually finding a way in by climbing a rose trellis and entering through the attic window. After the group makes some phone calls and says their goodbyes, Jess answers the phone and announces to all the other girls that it's the Moaner. Together, they listen to the bizarre phone call, which starts out with simply heavy breathing and then escalates into strange ranting and obscene language. Barb gets on the receiver and fires back with her own obscene comments.
Listen, you pervert, why don't you go over to Lambakai? They could use a little of this.
You big cunt.
You fucking creep.
I'm going to kill you.
Upset by the call, sorority girl Claire Harrison questions Barb's judgment in provoking an unstable individual and reminds her that a girl from town was raped recently by an unknown assailant. Barb reacts angrily and upsets Claire, who then goes upstairs to pack. Claire hears Claude, the house mother's cat, in her room. Even though the door is closed, she is unaware the killer is watching her from within her closet. In a morbid twist, the psychopath meows like Claude and lures Claire into the closet, where he lunges at her and wraps plastic cleaning bags around her head, smothering her to death.
Claude?
Who is it?
The following morning, Claire's father arrives saying that she failed to meet him at a train station. When he seeks her at the sorority house, he's shocked by the sexually suggestive posters he finds in her room. And also surprised that she has a boy's photo next to her bed. Mr. Harrison seems to blame Miss Mack for the permissive attitude in the house. Miss Mack assures him that Claire is a good girl and that she's probably just at one of the fraternity houses visiting Chris. Mr. Harrison offers to drop Miss Mack off at the store on his way there. Before they leave, Miss Mack hears Claude meowing but cannot find him. Later that day, Jess visits Peter while he's practicing for a very important audition, and she breaks some news to him. She is unexpectedly pregnant. Peter thinks it's good news, but Jess admits that she wasn't even going to tell Peter about it. Jess intends to get an abortion. Peter is adamantly opposed to this and makes an ominous threat against Jess for even considering such a thing. Back at the sorority house, Jess receives another obscene phone call. This one is more elaborate. The killer speaks in several different voices and makes references to Agnes and Billy. He also seems to be speaking in the voices of two adults, presumably the parents of Agnes and Billy. The voices even seem to overlap at times, adding to the unsettling effect.
Hello? Hello? Who is this?
Please stop. Oh, God.
Meanwhile, Harrison and two other sorority members, Barb and Phil, attempt to report Claire's disappearance to Sergeant Nash. Nash does not take them seriously until Chris Hayden, Claire's boyfriend, barges in angrily later in the day and demands something be done about it. Chris angrily lashes out at Sergeant Nash for having a big mouth when Lieutenant Fuller overhears and becomes interested in the case.
Mr. Harrison's daughter is missing, and now at the house where she lives, the other girls are getting obscene phone calls.
He has already been taking a missing persons report from a distraught mother, whose 13-year-old daughter, Janice, has suddenly disappeared while on her way home from school. A search party is held that night for Claire, in which Harrison, Chris, and most of the sorority get involved. Miss Mack tells them that she's leaving for her sister's house and may not be there when they return. When Jess leaves, Miss Mack packs her bags and calls a cab. But she is distracted by sounds from the attic. The killer lures her into the attic by making sounds like a cat. When Miss Mack opens the attic door, he swings a large hook at her, designed to pull things up into the attic crawl space. The hook impales her under her chin and hangs her. The extensive search of the park turns up the body of Janice, the 13-year-old missing girl. When Jess rushes back to the house, she receives another frightening call from the killer. Again, he uses multiple voices and reenacts some weird scenario involving naughty Billy and baby Agnes. This time, Jess calls the police to report the obscene phone call. As she talks to Sergeant Nash, a figure approaches her from behind and startles her. It's Peter, who has been napping in the house while waiting for Jess to return. Peter proposes to Jess. He would like to quit the conservatory and marry Jess and be a father to their child. Jess, however, refuses. She does not want to get married or have a child yet. She has things she wants to accomplish first. Peter becomes hurt and angry, telling Jess that she's talking about killing their baby as if it's like having a wart removed. Jess becomes frightened by his mounting hostility and tells Peter to leave. Just as Peter is walking out, Phil arrives with Lieutenant Fuller and the phone company rep named Graham, who puts a tap on the house phone. Fuller notices that Peter seemed angry, and he questions Jess about it. He also looks around Claire's room and asks more questions about her. Graham asks if there is another phone in the house, and Fuller tells him that it is a private line belonging to Miss Mack, and that there have been no obscene phone calls on it. So they don't tap it. Fuller tells Jess that he'll be listening in all of her phone conversations from the station, and Graham tells her to keep the caller on the line for as long as possible so he can trace the call. Fuller has also left an officer in a squad car outside to watch the house. When he leaves, Phil begins crying and tells Jess that she's sure Claire is dead. Tired and emotionally exhausted, she goes to bed and Jess waits for another phone call. Meanwhile, the killer goes into Barb's room and watches her sleeping. Barb, who has asthma, suddenly suffers an attack, and Jess rushes in to her aid with an inhaler. Barb tells her that she had a nightmare with a stranger coming into her room. Barb goes back to sleep, and Jess is distracted by a group of Christmas carolers at the front door. The singing masks the sounds of Barb's murder. The killer returns and stabs her to death using a glass ornament near her bed. The carolers are suddenly rushed off by a concerned parent who has found out about a murder of the little girl at the park.
A girl murdered over in the park tonight.
Yes, I heard.
Your phone's ringing.
Jess hears the phone ringing, and it's the killer. He wails at her in a strange voice and says, "It's just like having a wart removed," before hanging up. Jess is shocked. These are words used in private with Peter. Lieutenant Fuller picks up on this, but Jess denies that it has any significance. Phil comes back downstairs and Jess tells her about what just happened. Phil seems to not think the killer could possibly be Peter, and neither does Jess, but she is not sure. Peter himself calls then and begs Jess not to kill the baby. The conversation doesn't last long enough to trace either, but Fuller calls to ask Jess what they were talking about. Jess admits she's pregnant and that Peter objects to an abortion. And Fuller seems to think that Peter could be the caller after all. Jess, however, has a revelation. Peter was there at the house with her when one of the calls came through, so it couldn't be Peter calling. Jess is convinced that she can now rule out Peter as a suspect, and both she and Phil are relieved. They have a brief laugh after they are startled by two bumbling men from town who are out looking for the killer. Phil and Jess go around the house, locking all the doors and windows. When Phil goes into Barb's room, just inside the door, someone whispers, "Agnes," and slams the door shut. Jess tries to find Phil, but the phone rings. It's the killer again. This time, Jess keeps him on the phone long enough for Graham to trace the call. They're coming from 6 Belmont Street, the same address as the sorority house itself. Nash radios Fuller with the news, and Fuller realizes the calls are coming from the house. He tries to radio the policeman parked outside the sorority house, but the cop is now dead, his throat slit by the killer. Fuller radios Nash and tells him to call Jess and warn her to get out of there without letting her in that the killer is in the house with her. Nash, of course, is unable to do this. When Jess tells him she is going upstairs to get Phil and Barb, Nash admits that the calls are coming from inside the sorority house itself.
Jess, the caller is in the house.
The calls are coming from the house.
Jess!
Jess, get up!
Jess is terrified and screams out for Phil and Barb over and over again. The house is silent. Instead of leaving, Jess gets a poker from the fireplace and goes upstairs. In Barb's room, she finds the bodies of both Phil and Barb on the bed. From the crack in the door, Jess sees the killer's eye watching her. "Agnes, it's me, Billy. Don't tell what we did," he whispers. Jess slams the door on him and runs. Howling in rage and pain, the killer chases after her. With no time to unlock the front door, Jess heads for the cellar. The killer catches her hair as she passes the stairs. But Jess is able to break free and bolt the cellar door behind her just in time. Eventually, the maniac stops pounding on the door, and Jess hears sounds as if he is going out the front door. Unsure, she remains in the cellar. Through the basement windows, Jess can see someone prowling around the house. It's Peter. He calls out to her, but Jess ignores him. Peter breaks a window and enters the basement with her. Outside, Fuller arrives with other policemen close behind, and they find the patrol man dead in the car. Hearing Jess screaming from inside the house, they break in. By the time they reach the basement, they find Jess and Peter lying together. They appear to both be dead, but Jess stirs. She has killed Peter with the fire poker. Believing Peter was the killer, a doctor gives Jess a sedative and she is sleeping. Mr. Harrison suddenly goes into shock. The doctor intervenes and wants to take Mr. Harrison to the hospital. Chris leaves with them. And so do the other police officers, leaving Jess alone and unconscious with a guard in front of the house. After they leave, the house is silent. The attic door opens. The bodies of Claire and Miss Mac are still up there, unnoticed by anybody yet. The killer climbs out of the attic, saying, "Agnes, it's me, Billy." As the camera pulls away from the house, we see the lone police officer on the front porch smoking a cigarette. Suddenly, the phone begins to ring, just as it did after all the murders that came before. Now it's time to talk horror with my amazingly talented and vampiric guest, Matthew Moyer. He is a columnist for the local newspaper, Orlando Weekly, with a focus on the music scene. He's also involved in game-changing drag shows, and he books shows as well. My husband and I like to call him our pixie goth prince in secret. How are you doing? Matt, and what are you working on?
I'm doing great. I'm happy to be here to talk about this delightfully nasty and festive piece of cinema. What am I working on? I don't know. We're just sort of like wrapping up the year at work. I'm sort of maybe thinking of doing a couple photo zines for Zine Fest in mid-December, but other than that, not much, delightfully.
Awesome. I love Zine Fest. I don't know if you know, but Angie and I used to make a zine together called Don't Tell Mom.
I have one of those episodes.
You do? You have one of those?
Issues from Zine Fest several years ago we traded
for. Yes. I love it. I wish, I don't know if I could get her to make Don't Tell Mom with me again. It would be really nice if I could.
Make it your Christmas wish.
I know. So I really love the tagline for the movie we're talking about today. So we're talking about the original Black Christmas. The tagline is, "If this movie doesn't make your skin crawl, it's on too tight." So how does your skin feel today?
My skin feels great, very well preserved, as if it's been wrapped in plastic for several months.
Nice, as if you've been in a cold attic, just not decomposing, just, you know.
Spoiler alert.
I think, I mean, maybe that's a good way to preserve a body. I don't know. They don't seem to smell anything in the house. So, you know, that was one of the things that I was like, do they not smell it like days in? But I'm like, you know what? It's snowing.
It was around Christmas, so they probably had a lot of scented candles all over the place. College kids are usually a bit ripe to begin with as well, especially these oddly middle-aged looking college kids.
Oh my God. They were. One of the actors, I think Peter, the guy who played Peter, was like 38 or something. Like he was not, he's playing like a college student and he's 38.
Yeah.
Like, you're nowhere near a college student age.
What, page boy for coat? Come on, that's what I mean.
Yeah. It's like, okay. And, you know, he was ready to be a dad because he was 38. I just wanted to talk about some tropes that this movie began and go into, like, what did you notice about the movie and, you know, what stands out to you with this classic?
There's a number of things. I like the fact that this was sort of the director Bob Clark's mic drop when he left the horror genre. Like, he made his name in horror. In fact, he first became sort of, I guess, cult famous by a film he made in Florida called a zombie film called Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things. Made his way to Canada through some arts funding. And, of course, Black Christmas was filmed in Canada, even though they have little strategic American flags.
Yeah, that is something that came across my research as well, is, that it was in Canada. But they were like, but don't worry, the killing happens in America.
So it was sort of his final film, and it was like he sort of went all out as far as what I think are some pretty, there's a lot of really adventurous aspects of the film. The use of POV was, I think, I'm not going to say it was the first, because I'm sure Orson Welles or someone had some POV in a film somewhere, but I think that was the first from where the POV became the killer's personality and physical presence. We never see the killer, but we see what he's seeing throughout the movie. I think also the way the sound is used, it's so prevalent beyond just like setting a mood. It's almost like, again, it's almost like another character in the film. I think the fact that, again, we don't see the killer, I think that is a really, really amazing thing, because now this was considered sort of one of the first slasher movies. And in stark contrast to so many that came after, like when you think of a Jason or a Freddy or a Leatherface, who are all very like face forward, you only see, I think, the killer's eyeball once and their silhouette once, and you can't put that on a t-shirt, you know?
No, definitely. I think that's a good point that there is the kind of iconic image of him in a shadow and you see like one eye, but that could be anyone.
And it's also interesting in that it's a very panicked eyeball. Like, I don't want to read too much into just seeing like a flash of one, but the way the pupils darting around, it's not like a calm, cool, collected killer. That's to me like almost like hysterical for a panicked frenzy, honestly.
Yeah, no, it is very psychotic. I felt like there was something, honestly, I felt like there's something very real about this character as a serial killer that is preying on a group of sorority girls that he has literally no connection to. Because, you know, while serial killers are rare, a lot of times when we do see serial killers, they don't have a connection to their victims. They just have like a profile of what they're going after. So I found that very interesting and more realistic. And I think that's why this movie scared me more than others too.
I think he leaves it to you to fill in the blanks, and then that becomes so much more terrifying than it all being spelled out. I think he purposely, from listening to some interviews, didn't give the killer backstory. and almost treated it like, or him like a force of nature. You know what I mean? Where it's just like he just blew into the house. And then I don't think he ever left the house in the course of the film. Once he climbed up that trellis, I think he was in the house like for the entirety of that film, which is crazy to think about.
This kind of started the trope of like the calls coming from inside the house.
Yes, yes.
It was definitely, I think it was the first movie who actually used that. And that came from the, like the urban legend of like the babysitter.
It was a beautifully rendered scene too, where they had the phone company employee running down that hall. It had a bit of an element of like police procedural to it, like sort of, which I thought was just like that scene to me gives me chills still.
Do you think that's actually how they trace calls?
I choose to believe
this. I was just like watching this guy run around and like plug into all these boxes, and I'm thinking like that would take forever. Like, how do you even know what box you're going to?
What if it was a long distance call?
Yeah, like what the hell? Like it was. I was very much in the back of my head. I was like, is that for real? Is that really how that happened?
The use of film was amazing, though, as far as the graphic nature of the, it's too glib to call it prank calls, but when he was sort of leaving those obscene, or making obscene calls, that was just amazingly done, and still sort of, like, I think jars to this day as well.
Oh, I definitely agree. I think as a woman who, you know, has had calls in the past, it is very eerie, and I think that part is what really gets women. To have like a stalker, to have this stalker saying obscene things, and it's like everyone wants to laugh it off like it's a joke, but it's not a joke. Like, this person is serious, and I think it's funny. I was listening to another podcast again about that part, and they were downplaying it a lot and saying like, oh, it was really dumb, or that just it wasn't scary. And I think I was thinking, you know, for men, I can see how that wouldn't be scary from their perspective, like getting these prank calls, because how many men are called and then stalked?
Yes.
So, but as someone who, I actually did have a stalker one time. And he would call and kind of leave these, it would be really breathy, the same kind of way. So, like, that was almost triggering to me and made it, like, even scarier. But I think that's when women really have a strong reaction to this, because a lot of us have had these experiences. The funny thing with my stalker, I kind of turned the book on him and I started stalking him. So then he realized I was crazy and then stopped calling. So
I've read into the techniques behind how they like assembled those calls, and it was amazing. The director, I mean, he must have known that this was going to be a pivotal element. He hired an actor to do the main voice, and then they layered these. And then there was a woman in the sound effects department who did some of the voices too. And then apparently two other actors occasionally pitched in as well, which is wild, because then it becomes like a mass of voices, like saying conflicting things, then almost becomes like a sort of audio psychosis. The main actor, even like Frank Mancuso, stood on his head when he recorded all his Billy parts.
That's really funny. Just to see like what kind of vocal effect it would create. That's really inventive. I'm glad that you brought up that point, because there are so many different voices going on, and it's very confusing to listen to. And it sounds like it's several people, so I'm glad to know that it is several people. But it was either several people or one really talented person vocally that can just throw their voice all around. But yeah, that definitely added to the eeriness of the calls.
There are some references to something that happened between a Billy and an Agnes.
Yes.
And that the parents aren't supposed to know about.
Yes. So they must be related in some way.
Yeah.
And it's like, where's Agnes? Mm-hmm. Where did you put the baby?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's also theories that that was even misdirection,
I think it was. I don't think there was really a backstory to this character, but those calls made you think that there was something more to it than just this person calling and being psychotic.
Yeah. I also, going back to the sound real quick, I love that the... I'm skipping around. I'm so sorry.
No, you're fine.
The piano being smashed, that some of that crashing then ended up in other parts of the film. Apparently, they love the sound of that so much. It just kept reappearing, which was... and the sound, the person who did the soundtrack apparently listened to a lot of John Cage and other experimental composers because he wanted to make it sound as sort of unhinged and odd and unsettling as possible. And I think mission accomplished.
Yeah, no, I definitely, when I was going through like the audio bits and stuff in this episode, I think one of the snippets that I took actually probably was him smashing the piano.
Yes, yes.
And because, yeah, it does, it has this very eerie feel to it. It's very, and it's really symbolic at the same time,
yeah.
I think.
And even that scene where Peter sort of whiffs his final recital, I just, like, I'll watch that and I'll just think, I can't think of another sort of slasher or horror film where something, a scene like that took place. It's really incredible.
Yeah, I think the element of, like, the emotional connection that you kind of get to some of these characters is stronger than in other slashers. And that worked in some of the characters' favors and then not in some of the other characters. Exactly. Yeah. You know, it had, like, the opposite effect where there were some that was like, eh, I don't really care that you died.
I do think that the director tried to make the characters more fleshed out than a lot of like a Friday the 13th or something like that. I think he wanted to represent teenagers, even middle-aged teenagers, in a serious, realistic fashion versus, I remember there's an interview where he says it's not going to be beach blanket bingo.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is good. We don't want that.
Yes.
I mean, we want this. So I have like a few little things in here. I really found Miss Mac to be interesting character, where everyone kind of thought she was this really great caretaker for them, but then it turns out she's just like talking shit behind their backs. She's an alcoholic.
Yes, hides whiskey in the toilet bowl.
Yes, the whiskey in the toilet bowl. That was a really great, I didn't expect it either. I was like, what the hell is she doing in the toilet bowl?
Yeah.
And she's got this whiskey bottle connected to a chain.
Yeah. Well, that's another reason why the movie works. These like bits of offbeat comedy that are actually funny sort of add more depth to the whole thing.
Yeah, for sure. And then when the first girl who dies, so like Claire's dad comes and he is blaming Miss Mac for the girl's like debauchery or whatever. I'm saying that wrong. Debauchery. Yeah. I thought that was a very interesting dynamic between her and the dad.
Yeah. It almost seems like that could have been an episode of a sitcom or something like that. They're sort of very like his disapproving Puritan looks and her like trying to hide the poster with the naked people on it and things like that. It was again, a really, just there's these interesting side roads that this movie takes.
I really, really loved this movie for the underlying female, like feminist roles that they had.
Absolutely.
And just like this, one thing I didn't realize is that this movie came 2 years after Roe versus Wade was passed.
Yes.
So, the director said that he didn't purposely make this like a feminist movie. But I have a hard time thinking that he didn't, or maybe he didn't consciously make it a feminist film, but I think at least subconsciously he made it one.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you know, I think in less skilled hands, her saying that she was going to get an abortion would make her the film's ultimate villain who would have immediately been killed, you know, but instead she was the emotion. Well, she was clearly the she was the emotional core of that film.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, she survived. No spoilers.
Yeah.
And, you know,
or at least we think she did.
Yeah.
I like to think she did.
Yeah. She makes it through the credits at the very least. I would say, and I don't think they treat any of these characters as throwaway or disposable. Each character is different. They're not interchangeable. And, they just don't seem, I don't know, there's a lot to them. There's a lot going on. And so, yeah, I would say it's a feminist film.
Yeah. I think even Barb. Oh, yeah. So Barb's like this party girl bringing up all kinds of inappropriate things. She's very much like, fuck you to the man. Mm-hmm. Whenever she takes the phone. Yeah. She's like, her fellatio joke. Yeah. And then taking the phone, and she's not afraid to speak her mind. Mm-hmm. And I really found it funny when you could tell she is like the girl that just goes for like the shock factor. And everyone kind of, they're really, when she starts talking about like the turtles having sex.
Yes.
You can see everyone's expression, like, they're like, oh, here she goes again. And then she gets into the details and they're all laughing and they're playing along. And, you know, you could tell this isn't the first time, but I can also see on their faces that they're just waiting for the ball to drop when she goes too far.
Yes.
And she does when she talks about the zebra.
Yep.
I think she also, with Barb, I think that she felt a little bit of guilt when it came to Claire, because at the end of that scene, she kind of blows up, and because the girls are like, you should go to bed, you're drunk. And she's like, I know that you guys blame me for her disappearing, or, you know, because she's way more abrasive and Claire is very timid. They're like polar opposites of each other. So I think she held a lot of guilt over that.
Yeah, I think she's pretty much, you can tell it's tearing her apart, because she's pretty much drinking, like, from that, you know what I mean, from when Claire gets killed, on to her own eventual demise. Mm-hmm. So it's clear that she was really, really racked with guilt over that. Oh, Claude.
Yes, Claude.
True villain of the film.
To kind of backtrack a little bit too, I like that you mentioned that when it came to Jess, you would think that she wouldn't be the final girl. Like, but also, I don't think final girl was really a thing yet. Like, it was just starting.
Yeah, no, I don't think. Yeah.
So, but what it would later turn into is very different than what it was in this film. So, like, Claire is the most modest. She's the shy girl. Mm-hmm. She definitely fits that, like, innocent virgin victim that would last till the end. And Jess is, she stays alive, but she's definitely, she has an active sex life. She's going to get an abortion. She's not going to marry the man. She's standing up for herself. And she's like, well, I want XYZ out of my life. I don't want to be a mom and I don't want to be a wife. Mm-hmm. And I love that she's just such a strong character.
And it, even down to her final act, where she takes the poker and runs back inside to save her friends. That's just sort of showing you, you know, just her sort of, like, the word isn't thriving, but she doesn't crumble under this, like, really, really horrible adversity of seeing, you know, her friends being murdered, someone coming after her, it might be her boyfriend.
Mm-hmm. She's not afraid. She's not afraid of confrontation, which so many female characters are. Yeah. And, yeah, I love that about her. I think I really related to her as a character, I think.
Down to when she tells Peter that she's going to have an abortion, she's very matter-of-fact. There's mm-hmm. no sort of, like, it's just very, she states it very objectively, almost, like, just matter-of-factly, and there will be no discussion on the matter.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what sets him off to where I think his character unravels from that point on.
Yeah, because he treats her like she is property.
Yes, yeah.
he thinks that he can just say, we're going to get married. He's not asking her if she wants to get married. He's saying, we're going to get married. I'm going to marry you. Yeah. Like, who the hell are you coming in here and saying you're going to marry me? Mm-hmm. That's not how this works.
Yeah.
And she very much calls him out on it. And I love that. So this movie is kind of like in between for a whodunit and a slasher.
100%. Yes.
So I found that very interesting. And I saw it in one of my, in my research, I saw it referred to as an Italian. I'm not going to say. Yes.
I can see that because, wow, it's so rich. You're just like drowning in atmosphere during that film. So yeah, I can see that. And I never thought of that before. That's really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's a typical giallo, which follows the structure of a murder mystery, albeit an especially violent one for this. Mm-hmm. And the killer will usually be revealed as one of the established characters, but in this movie, it's not. But they do want us to think, like, there's a lot of red herrings. Like, they want us to believe that Peter is the one who is murdering everyone, and he has motive. They give him, like, the motive. I don't know if they give him the means, because he's sometimes in other places, or he's with the girls for one of the calls. Yeah. So he has motive, but not the means.
Yeah. But then the cops are convinced. Like, they're like, he's our man. Mm-hmm. So that's, yeah.
But then I do feel like they kind of dropped the ball in the last scene where he finds her in the attic. Mm-hmm. Or not attic, the basement. Basement. Because how does he know she's in there?
I think their whole thing is like, he just spends a solid portion of the film just lurking around the house.
He does.
Which is an interesting parallel to the killer. Like, these two psychotic men just lurking either in or around.
Could they be working together?
quite possibly. Because it did seem extreme when he, like, punched the window in. That basement.
Yeah.
Like, that seemed a bit, even if he was sort of in, you know, histrionics at that point, there's still.
Right. I'm like, he's so afraid of her being in trouble or her being in danger that he's going to break the window and, like, break into the basement.
Yeah.
And he's so confident that she's in there when I doubt any of them spend time in the basement.
Exactly.
Yeah, so what the hell is this?
During a not Canadian winter.
Yeah. They don't show Jess attacking him. But then the police come in and you can see him like cradled in her lap. Almost like he's the baby now.
Yes. Yeah.
And she's got the poker still and she's not letting go of that thing. And his face is like bloodied, obviously, like he's been hit with a poker. Mm-hmm. So the wounds match the murder weapon.
Yep. Yep.
I have a hard, like, there's not enough blood. He could have survived that.
That's another thing that's interesting about this film. There's very little blood.
Like, yeah.
That's it as far as blood you see on camera during the film. And I think that's another thing that sort of makes it unique among slasher films in that they cut away
a lot. Yeah.
And I think that's, like, as I said earlier, the movie depends on your mind to fill in the blanks, and often, depending on the type of person you are, that can be much more terrifying than any sort of practical effects they can use.
Yes, I think that it is. I think it's whenever you're left up to your own imagination and you kind of have these blanks to fill in, it's a lot more terrifying than just being given an enormous amount of gore that is unrealistic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For the most part. people do bleed a lot when they're cut.
Yeah.
So talking about murder scenes. So the murder scene when I believe it's Phil. No, Barb. Barb is the one who is murdered with the unicorn.
Yes.
The unusually large horn of the unicorn, which I'm going to say it's a metaphor for a penis.
Yeah, I think that's fair. It's really interesting. I listened to a number of interviews with the director, and he always demurred on that when questioned about that. He'd sort of brush it aside and change the subject to something else. So we don't definitively know, but yeah, I think that's a fair assumption.
Yeah. I mean, any kind of stabbing is kind of erotic type of thing whenever it comes to serial killers and that mode of killing.
Yeah. And Billy has the character, the non-character of Billy has a psychosexual element to it. So I think that all falls in line.
Yeah. He says some pretty vulgar stuff that I can't remember exactly word for word what he said, but he talks about like a pink pussy or something.
Yeah, see what comes flying.
It's, you know, I was not expecting that. And when I heard it, I was like, oh, that's abrasive.
But then immediately after that, his voice goes completely bloodless and flat.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, I'm going to kill you, and hangs up the phone. And that's, God, it's still, that gets me.
Yeah, it's super, I mean, it just plays into the whole, like, being a psychopath.
Mm-hmm.
He definitely, like, maybe has multiple personalities or something. That's almost kind of what I was thinking, too, with all the different voices. Yeah. Like, is he going through his multiple personalities?
I think that was definitely a factor.
Yeah.
I do want to bring up one tiny thing real quick. I love how, like, going back to the giallo thing, a lot of those directors are very deliberate in their use of how they film color.
Mm-hmm.
I have never seen, like, I'm talking, there are a few Christmas films that lovingly linger over Christmas lights the way this one does. It's just, like, it's really incredible. It's just stunning, stunning camera work.
Yeah. No, I think that the background to this was really important. Like, this, just the scenery, and the way that the camera would pan over the doors and the hallways, and it just really set a kind of a bleak feel. You got that bleak feel of, like, especially at the end of the movie when she's in the house alone.
Yeah.
It's just like going through all the hallways, and it's so eerie.
And you can just feel the cold chill just, like, on your skin. Like,
Yeah.
Do you think it's interesting that this director also did the two sides of the Christmas movie coin, basically?
Mm-hmm.
Like, this one and then A Christmas Story, which you can watch for 24 hours on Christmas Eve going into Christmas Day. Like, that's absolutely incredible to me that a person can be that versatile to where you sum up, like, both sides of the quote-unquote Christmas canon.
I actually find that interesting, but I don't think of A Christmas Story as a really happy Christmas movie. I feel like he hates Christmas.
I agree with that. Yeah. There's some of the same screwball comedy shows up in both movies too, which is really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I can't even think of any scenes from that movie. Like, I don't know, the turkey falling off the counter and whatnot. You know, it's just always great.
One
little bit of trivia. This was Elvis Presley's favorite Christmas film. He would watch it every Christmas Eve, and to the point where after his death, his family would continue to watch it for several years after.
I do love that. I have a little bit more respect for Elvis Presley now that I know that. another thing I loved about Barb is I'm pretty sure they were trying to express the message that, like, she was a lesbian or something.
Whoa,
or at least.
Whoa, wow.
So she is reading a magazine, and I'm pretty sure it was a Playboy.
Amazing.
And she's like, yeah, so I'm pretty sure there's like an element of either bisexuality or being a lesbian in there.
I think she's definitely intended as, like, a libertine character.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even like her aesthetic was flawless, like the constant chokers and the bangs in the face, the cigarette poised elegantly in her hand. Like, she was. I don't know how much that was Margot Kidder, bringing that look to the table, or, you know, more like a directorial lead. But whatever, it was a great collab, and she looked amazing.
Okay, so another feminist, little tidbit that I noticed was Phil was originally going to spend Christmas with her boyfriend, but had changed her plans to go skiing with Barb and Jess to make Barb feel better about her mother abandoning her over the holidays. There's definitely some family, what am I trying to say? I'm not trauma.
Conflict.
Yeah. There's some conflict there between Barb and her mom. You can see it. I believe it was at the beginning. She gets off the phone and she's upset.
That phone call was a very heartbreaking scene. It was very
brief.
but it was very powerfully done.
Yeah. And but Phil staying back to be with her, it was very much like turning like the whole bros before hoes on its head. True. And it's like, we're going to stick together. And these girls really did support each other.
Yeah, agreed.
I love that about this. So let's talk about Claude really quick. Please, Claude the cat. Please. I love Claude, and I feel so bad for Claude.
I also love Claude, but I come from a different angle. I think Claude's the actual villain of the film.
I don't agree.
He leads several characters to their grisly demise, and then exults over their dead bodies and licks their faces, chills with their killer up in the attic for a good portion of the movie. Looks out the window placidly. I think he's the puppet master. I think he's pulling the strings.
I can see where you're coming from that angle, but I don't think a cat could ever be that callous.
he sold out Mrs. Mack very hard, though. That was brutal.
He did. But he was also trapped up there in that basement. Mm. He had nowhere to go. I felt very bad for him. I felt like he was being used and to trap others, and he was an unwilling participant. He's a cat. He doesn't know.
I'm just saying, there's a 10% chance that Billy could have been his cat's paw in the film.
Well, we will never know. You know what's funny though, when I was watching the scene where Claude is in Claire's lap and starts licking the plastic bag.
Yeah.
My cat licks plastic all the time.
Mine does too. Yeah.
It's very annoying.
Yes. Apparently that was unprompted. That was like just a happy accident that they happened to be filming. But cat owners know that you cannot keep a cat from licking a plastic bag. So.
Yeah. I don't know what it is about plastic bags that they just can't stay away from. Yeah.
Exulting in his gory triumph.
Well, I mean, he must have gotten, like, what, cats? I have 6 cats. And if I am to die and they are locked up with me, I expect them to eat my corpse.
Immediately, within 6 hours, probably.
Yeah, I'm okay with it, though. I surrender my body to my cats if I was to die. They, you know, it could be, like, organ donor on your ID. I would say, you know, feed me to my cats. if they're locked with me and they have no way to eat, let my cat survive off my dead corpse.
I have a question for you. Where does this fall for you on the Christmas horror canon? If you had to give your top, I think this is now, for me, it's my number one. I love Silent Night, Deadly Night. I even like that Killer Snowman movie, Jack Frost. This one is just leaps and bounds. Just as far as sheer artistry, over any of those.
Yeah, it's definitely in my top 3. I'm a big Krampus fan, so I really like the Krampus movie. The one with Toni Collette. I love Toni Collette. Mm-hmm. It's just such a good movie, I think. It's so good. So that one, I watch it every year. Mm-hmm. I can't go without watching Krampus.
Yeah.
It's not Christmas. It's not Christmas without Krampus.
This one is Claude. Claude. What? No, I will not follow you up to the attic, Claude. this has become an annual viewing for me too.
I think after this, it has now become an annual viewing for me. Oh, there was one more thing. The Bad Santa was
so good. The Gene Child good. Like Bad Santa is like,
it's like swearing in front of the kids. Yeah. Were they giving the kids drinks? Were they getting kids drunk?
They gave them cigarettes. Still incredible mane of hair. Like, wow, that was... Oh. That was another thing. Like, you don't even need to watch Bad Santa. Just watch that scene from Black Christmas and you get your fill of that. Like, what
a movie. And if anything, that scene had very much... A Christmas Story feel.
Oh my, yes, the scene where the kid goes to the mall. Oh, wow, yes to that. Rewrote a lot of the original script for this movie, the director, which I suspect, I mean, he, again, that was another thing that he wouldn't really talk much about in detail in interviews, but I suspect a lot of this was his vision.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. Definitely. I think I will be making this movie one of my rewatches every single year. It's definitely a classic in my book. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed it. And thank you for coming and talking with me about this amazing cult classic.
It's a pleasure. I hate the sound of my own voice, but I love this movie so much that I could not say no. Oh, and also, if you're looking to watch it, it's on all the worst free streaming platforms you can find it on. Pluto, Tubi, Roku, all that. So please indulge in it repeatedly because it's out there for free.
Yes, please watch it. Now it's time for the true crime of it all. Ray Moore, the screenwriter of Black Christmas, was inspired by the urban legend, The Babysitter and the Man Upstairs, and a series of murders that took place in Montreal, Quebec. Moore wrote the screenplay under the title Stop Me. The urban legend, originally written in the 1960s, became very popular in the 1970s and featured a babysitter being harassed by phone calls from a stranger. As she sits alone in the living room doing her homework, the kids upstairs sound asleep, she starts receiving phone calls from a laughing man saying, "Have you checked the children?" After repeated calls, the scared girl calls the police. The cops put a tracer on her phone, and after the creepy man calls again, the cops call back and tell the girl the calls are coming from inside the house. The babysitter is told to leave the house immediately, and when the police arrive, they find both kids stabbed to death upstairs. The urban legend itself was based on an unsolved murder in the 1950s of a teenage babysitter just days before her 14th birthday. This true story took place on March 18th, 1950, in Columbia, Missouri, when Janet, an 8th grader, showed up at the home of the Romack family on a cold night. She was there to babysit a little boy named Gregory, who was already asleep in his bed. The parents were going to play cards with friends, a rare night out for the pregnant mother. It would be an easy night, but the patriarch of the family, Ed Romack, still wanted to keep Janet and his son safe, so he told her to turn the porch light on and be careful if anyone knocked at the door, and even showed her where the shotgun was kept. At 10:35 p.m., the Columbia Police Department received a call from a frightened voice yelling, "Please come quick." Before the police could get any information from the caller, the line went dead. As it was late at night, no one was on the board for the phone company, so no calls could be traced without knowing who was calling and from where. The police were helpless to do anything. Exactly 3 hours later, at 1:35 a.m., the Romacks returned home and found their window blinds open and the front porch light on. Someone had come to the door while they were away. Though the front and back door were locked, a window on the side of the house had been broken into. The parents of young Gregory went inside and found Janet on the living room floor in a pool of blood. She had fought for her life, but was sexually assaulted and strangled to death with a cord. The parents rushed to the room of their child and found him safe and sound, asleep in his bed, unaware of the horrors that had played out on the other side of his door. Jeanette's killer was never found, but there was a man suspected of the murder who had taken a liking to her. As if that isn't enough, Black Christmas is also based on true events that happened in the city of Westmount, Montreal, in November 1943. The real-life crime was that of George Webster, a 14-year-old boy who bludgeoned his mother to death with a baseball bat in their family home. His brother, sister, and family friend also sustained head injuries from the bat, but were able to recover in the hospital. A reason for the attacks was never described, which directly parallels never truly finding out why the killer did what he did in Black Christmas. While he was deemed criminally responsible and charged with his mother's murder on February 28, 1944, he was declared unfit to stand trial and transferred to a mental hospital. Screenwriters Roy Moore and Timothy Bond used aspects of these murders to write the script for Black Christmas, which was tentatively titled Stop Me at the time. The reasoning for this possible name was a reference to William Herons, aka the Lipstick Killer, who killed three women in Chicago between 1945 and 1946. Herons wrote Stop Me in lipstick at a crime scene, and the alias stuck with him from that day forward. As we can see, there were quite a few inspirations for the Black Christmas Killer. The combination of these real-life murderers plus the urban legend made for a deranged serial killer with no apparent motive. The title was changed to Black Christmas when filmmakers made numerous alterations to the script, primarily the shifting to a university setting with young adult characters, which is now the template for the cult classic. Now that that's over, let's end on a high note. If you're working on anything horror related and would like to collaborate on something, I would love the opportunity to connect with more people in the horror scene. I'm also thinking about making mini episodes, but I'm not really sure where to take that quite yet. So if you have any ideas, I'm open to suggestion. You can reach me on any of my social media accounts. My Instagram is Scream Queen Trivia, and my Facebook is Jenica Deer/Olin. I also have a Blue Sky account under the handle Scream Queen Podcast. I'm pretty sure mentioning that platform is all you need to know my political views without expressing any more. I decided as I make more episodes, you might want to know a little bit about the person behind the voice speaking at you. Before starting this podcast, I was a teacher for most of my daughter's childhood. I gave a good 14 years to private education. Well, I gave a good 14 years to private, public, and charter schools, with my expertise being in early childhood / elementary education. How does this translate into running a podcast that's about murder movies and true crime? Well, for starters, I'm good at planning, keeping people's attention that don't want to listen to me, and I got pretty good at storytelling by the end of my teaching career. Being a teacher sucks more than ever right now. Ask a veteran teacher. If there was a way out, they would be gone. Teaching in Florida is a particular beast on its own. That all said, I am using my skills to entertain and educate the masses on horror cinema and how true crime is intertwined with the genre. I'm also really enjoying all the research, and I hope I can turn this into something others enjoy as well. If you like what you heard here today, please rate, review, and subscribe to my podcast. Give it a little share as well if you are feeling extra generous. Please, for the love of all things horror, don't make me go back to teaching in this horrible state. This is officially a weekly podcast. Please be patient with me as I am also learning all of the technical audio stuff as I go. I'm preemptively cringing at any mistakes I've made thus far. Thank you for listening, and don't tell women what they can do with their bodies. Until next time, goodbye.